20. Caro and Barbara worked into the evening and then the night. Lorraine's mapping data was invaluable as a comparison to Julian's. The part of the brain apparently causing both of their extremely detailed lucid hallucinations was small and largely unmapped. Both subjects' imaging showed strong neuroconnections to the hippocampus, where memories were processed. No surprise there. More interesting were the strong connections to the nucleus accumbens, the so-called pleasure center, to the frontal cortex, seat of conscious cognition, and to the occipital lobe, interpreter of light and movement. But no signs of temporal lobe epilepsy. Caro frowned. The imaging was unequivocal. Whatever Lorraine had experienced, it was not the electrical storm known to produce religious or mystical experiences. Nor was there much activity in the parietal lobe, the section of the brain that told the self where the body began and ended. Decreased blood flow there, such as practiced and skillful meditators could control, was what led to a sensation of out-of-body experiences. This was something different. She didn't know what, except that there didn't seem to be anything like it in the scientific literature. But the mapping data were gorgeous. Barbara said, "If this holds up, we can have our pick of top journals for publication," Caro finished. They grinned at each other like 12-year-olds. Getting ready for bed, Caro checked her email. She'd almost skipped it. The hour was late, and her mind buzzed with mapping data. But she turned on the laptop. Two emails that weren't spam. The first from Ellen, saying that she and Kayla and Angelica were fine. The other was from Julian. "Lyle just called me with Aiden's lab tests. He does not have food poisoning. The hospital still does not know what he does have, although they say it is almost certainly not contagious. He's slowly feeling better, but they are keeping him for more tests. Your next implantee will therefore be Ben Clarby. Pre-op workup and imaging tomorrow, surgery the day after. Lyle says Aiden's symptoms are medically puzzling. Something here is not right." After you've done something once, even something you never in your life expected to do at all, it was easier to do it a second time. By her next surgery, Caro thought, it might even become routine. Ben Clarby's surgery went well. He seemed nervous, which was a little odd. Yes, he was only the third person to be implanted, but he had volunteered, and he didn't seem the type to be skittish about surgery. Still, some people reacted differently to the idea of having their head cut open right now instead of in a theoretical future. In residency, Caro had seen patients suddenly panic, change their mind, change their wills, and once, demand a second opinion while being wheeled into the OR. Molly put Ben under anesthesia. The chip was inserted into his brain, the lead wires connected, the small titanium case bolted to the top of his shaven skull. Unlike Julian and Lorraine, Ben didn't have naturally thick hair. The case was going to be permanently visible, but given the addiction of Julian's software team to baseball caps, Caro doubted that many people would see Ben's case anyway. This was the last surgery at which Ralph Egan would assist. Caro's next patient, replacing Aiden in the surgical lineup, would be another of Julian's techs, an awkward 20-something, improbably named Ivan Kyvan. What had his parents been thinking? Ivan, skinny and long-limbed, resembled a praying mantis. Julian said he was brilliant. For Ivan's operation, Trevor Abruzzo would assist. Ralph was leaving the compound late this afternoon, and James had organized a farewell tea in the refectory. Caro would have preferred not to go. She and Barbara wanted every spare minute to work on Lorraine's and Ben's mapping data, but she didn't want to offend Ralph, whom she liked. "Besides," Barbara said, You know that Molly would never let us skip a party. It's just tea, Caro said. James mentioned finger sandwiches and elegant tiny cakes. He's had his staff baking them all morning. For that gang of barely housebroken software kids? Well, let's check it out. The party did indeed feature tea and coffee in tall silver urns. I rented them, James said. James had recruited two of the nurses to pour. Traditionally considered an honor, you know. Picnic tables in the courtyard were covered with white tablecloths, presumably also rented. Platters held petit fours and small rolled sandwiches filled with watercress or prosciutto. Within a half hour, everything had been devoured. Julian's team had brought out bags of chips and Oreos, and Ralph was being toasted with something mixed in a plastic storage bin from an impressive array of liquor bottles with garish labels. No, no, James said. This is a tea. A tea. Molly, standing with Weigert and Caro, laughed. James, you can't stop them. With Julian at the hospital on Grand Cayman until midnight with Aiden, both cats are away, and the mice are going at it. Actually, I think I might try some of that rot gut, simply as a medical experiment. Caro, you're not still on itch meds, are you? No, but no thanks to the rot gut. Molly looked mischievously at Weigert. Doctor? No, thank you. I must speak to Dr. Egan and then excuse myself, I'm afraid. Press of work. Coward, Molly said cheerfully as Weigert made his escape. Look, Caro, Barbara's trying that concoction. If sensible Barbara is willing, won't you? Aren't you curious? Someone had brought out speakers, and music suddenly streamed through the compound, something with an infectious beat. The nurses had abandoned their posts at the beverage urns. One began to dance across the grass by herself, graceful and sinuous. Barbara stood with a drink in her hand, laughing with Ralph. Well, Caro said, maybe just a sip. 2 hours later, Rosita was dancing with Ivan Kyvan on the top of a picnic table. No one had wanted much dinner, and the kitchen staff, sulkily released by James, had joined the party. They'd brought their own music, and a Caribbean beat at one end of the courtyard, warred with rap at the other. Ralph had left for the airport, but it made no difference whatsoever. The party rocked on. Caro had had only 1.5 glasses of the concoction in the storage bin, the second glass tasting so different from the first that she suspected it was an entirely different mixture. But it had been so long since she'd drunk hard liquor, let alone whatever potent mixture this was, that she felt floaty and pleasantly fuzzy, giggling with Barbara in two beach chairs that had mysteriously appeared on the grass. The chairs had short legs, meant to rest on sand, and both women's legs stuck out straight in front of them. Molly danced nearby with a tall, good-looking busboy who spoke no English. Caro said, "She won't." "No," Barbara said. "Not with anyone in the compound. Julian would have her head." "I would have her head," Caro said. "I'm chief of medicine here." This suddenly struck her as so funny that she burst out laughing. Chief of medicine? Of a hospital with 6 beds, filling up with patients who believed that nothing really existed, not even time, until they themselves created it. Barbara laughed. "I've never seen you like this, Caro. It's nice. Just as nice as you're carefully making sure that Camilla is on duty for Lorraine and that I'm sober in case one of these idiots falls off a picnic table and splits his head open. I'm not a surgeon, but I can stitch up a bleeding skull." "You are competent in every way," Caro said magnanimously. She felt magnanimous. She felt very good. "And so is Molly, and me, and George, and Julian, and my great uncle, the Nobel laureate genius, and Aiden, and Ben, and Rosita, and Ivan, and..." Ivan made a misstep in his thrashing dance and fell off the picnic table. "Am I prescient or what?" Barbara said, instantly on her feet. "No, wait. He's getting up. He's fine. Alcohol-induced muscle relaxation." What an idiot. Even if Julian does say that Ivan is the best software engineer he's ever seen. Caro rose too. She misjudged the low height of the sand chair and fell onto the grass. Unhurt, she felt Barbara pull her up and say something to someone else. Caro, dizzy, lurched against Barbara's shoulder as she turned to look. A man stood beside them, quizzically surveying Caro. In the gathering dust, she couldn't see him well. Abruptly, the courtyard floodlights were turned on, and his face became clear. "Hi," he said. "Dr. Soames Watkins? I'm Trevor Abruzzo, your new surgeon."
"It's a party," she said, inanely, defensively, with as much dignity as she could muster.
"So I see," he said, and smiled. The next morning, all signs of the drunken party had vanished. Caro, only slightly hungover, met with Ivan Kyvan for his pre-surgery procedures. His MRI, which she went over with Barbara, showed no potential issues with his brain. Blood tests, personnel checks, pre-op interview. Trevor watched all of it carefully, saying little. His presence made Caro a bit nervous. He had performed so much surgery, under much more difficult conditions than she had. She didn't want to look like a newbie. When they finished with Ivan, Caro and Trevor went to the refectory for coffee so that she could answer any questions he might have. She was not going to explain the entire project to him. That daunting task would fall to Julian, back at the compound with the news that Aiden was recovering slowly on Grand Cayman. Since it was after breakfast hours and before lunch, the refectory was deserted, the coffee left over from breakfast. She took a sip, made a face, and said, "You must have questions, doctor." "Trevor, please."
"My first question is how you can drink this stuff."
She smiled. "You were with Doctors Without Borders in Africa. Are you telling me you drank only shade-grown organic coffee prepared with a French press?" He said,
"You can't imagine what we drank over there. And now here you are, laughing at me, when my sole reason for coming back from Africa was better coffee."
"And look how we've disappointed you."
"Life is just a vale of tears."
Despite herself, she smiled. This was not the formal professional interview she'd expected. She looked more closely at Trevor Abruzzo. At first glance, he seemed as unprepossessing as his online photos. Maybe 5'8", a little stocky, brown-going-gray hair, brown eyes behind glasses that looked able to survive being stomped on by an elephant. A brownish kind of non-special person until you looked more closely at his eyes behind the thick glasses. Caro didn't think she'd ever seen eyes that alive. They darted, gleamed, danced with humor, seemed to miss nothing. She said, "Do you mind if I ask you some questions?"
"No, of course not."
Trevor answered concisely all her questions about his history of implanting deep brain stimulation machinery, which was minimal. She went over the ways that this surgery was and was not the same as DBS, finishing with, "Do you have any questions about tomorrow's surgery? I'm not the person to discuss the overall project with you or the theory behind it. That would be Julian and George, Dr. Weigert."
"No questions about the surgery? You've been very thorough. I think I understand Dr. Weigert's theory. He sent me the draft of the book he's writing, and we've had some interesting exchanges about it online. I'm looking forward to meeting him."
Weigert had sent him the book? They'd communicated online? Caro hadn't received any information until she'd actually arrived here. And she still hadn't seen the full draft of George's book, only the notes he'd prepared for her. Something unpleasantly like jealousy
joined her increasingly jumbled reaction to Trevor Abruzzo. She said, "I have some trouble with Dr. Weigert's theory, but you minored in physics as an undergraduate, so maybe you can follow the math."
"Most of it, anyway. Weigert's theory is the reason I'm here."
She made a sudden decision. "This is not my business, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why are you here? With your record, you could get a position anywhere. Why did you come here to do this? Controversial surgery that certainly isn't going to help your career." He didn't seem affronted by the question, nor by the slight aggression with which she'd asked it. Nor did he answer right away. He sipped the dreadful coffee. Finally, he said,
"It's a fair question, and I'm glad you asked it.
But not an easy question to answer. I'll try." His eyes had changed yet again, to an intensity that nonetheless seemed aimed not at her, but at something she could not see.
"Have you read Kierkegaard?"
"Not recently."
"Or at all?" Kara wasn't sure, but didn't want to admit it.
He smiled.
"Understandable. What I read now is mostly detective novels, but Kierkegaard wrote something that has stayed with me for a long time. He said, there are two ways to be fooled. One is to believe what isn't true. The other is to refuse to believe what is true." George Weigert's theory could change how we interpret the world. His science is convincing, but science isn't the only tool for understanding the world. Direct experience has a place, even if it doesn't meet the scientific criteria of being quantifiable and replicable.
Caro's eyes widened. "You want to be implanted?"
"Yes."
"And Julian? Did he agree to that?"
"It was the major condition of my coming here. And you, of course, will do the surgery."
"I suppose I will, if Julian says so." Something in her words or expression caught his interest. His eyes changed expression again, but she wasn't sure to what. He didn't ask why she was here. Did that mean he already knew? About Paul Becker and Fairleigh Memorial? Maybe. About Ellen and Angelica and Kayla? No. Caro hadn't even discussed Ellen with Barbara and Molly. She certainly was not going to do so with this stranger, with the penetrating eyes and deceptively playful presentation. She said, "Does your wanting to be implanted have anything to do with the blog post you wrote about why you're no longer a Christian?" She'd succeeded in surprising him.
"You read that?"
"Yes. Research on my new colleague. It was startling."
"Why?"
"I don't know." He pushed his coffee cup away from him.
"I actually do have a French press in my room. And some good beans. After surgery tomorrow, I'll make you a decent cup of coffee."
"Sure." He wasn't going to answer her question, and Caro felt embarrassed to have asked it. Not her business. But then he said,
"I became a Christian because that is my culture's expression of belief in something larger than this earthly life, with ready-made rituals to embody that belief. If I'd been born in India, I'd have chosen to become Hindu. Congolese, and it might have been Kimbanguism. The framework is what I wanted. I left Christianity because I found, as with most other religions, that over time, the core belief in something larger had become encrusted with arbitrary rules, restrictions, exclusion of everyone who did not follow them. After I'm implanted, if I find that George Weigert's ideas about the universe are true, then they will become my framework for understanding that unseen something larger and more true than conventional science can offer."
"And how will you ever know if what you experience after you're implanted is true, or is just a complex, detailed, very convincing illusion.
I won't know until I've experienced it. But I'll tell you this, Caro. I disclosed to Watkins and Julian the usual occasional pot smoking, but not that I've done just about everything else you can think of. Mushrooms, coke, LSD, more exotic substances in Africa. People I tripped with were convinced that what they saw was real. But I could always tell it was not, even as I experienced it. If Julian and Watkins had known that, they might not have hired me, afraid I'd have a flashback during an operation.
Might you?
No.
Are you always so sure of yourself?
Not always. But about this, yes.
She nodded, unsure what to say.
Trevor wasn't like anyone she'd met before. Certainly unlike any surgeon she'd met, all of whom took care to conceal from colleagues such things as chemical indiscretions, religious vacillation, or any lapse in self-confidence. The goal for a neurosurgeon was to appear in control at all times.
My goal, too,
Caro admitted, but not aloud. Before she could respond to Trevor's last remark, Julian slid into the seat opposite her. He looked tired.
Good morning, surgeons. I just had a call from Aiden. He feels much better this morning than he did even when I left the hospital last night, and he can return to Cayman Brac in a few days. No final lab reports yet. Apparently, they're running some very esoteric tests. Caro, is everything set for Ivan's surgery tomorrow morning? And Trevor, are you ready for your grand tour of the compound?
Yes, Caro said as Trevor rose, smiled down at Caro, and silently mouthed, coffee. Caro sat a few minutes longer, exploring her reactions to what Trevor had said. A framework for understanding something larger than the earthly life. Did that mean he would connect with Lorraine's mystical experience, whatever it had been? Or with Julian's prosaic, by-the-numbers test of George's theory, with the creation of Trevi Fountain in the Wing 3 courtyard? In one sense, it struck Caro as juvenile to be searching for a framework for something larger than this earthly life, the sort of thing one did in one's 20s. Before the struggles of career advancement, bill paying, child rearing, or, in Trevor's case, surviving in a war zone. In another sense, however, that longing for something more never really died in most people, even if they did not acknowledge it openly. Watching clouds drift across the sky, then the clouds no longer there, and neither was Caro. She was nowhere and everywhere, woven into the fabric of the universe. She was the clouds, the grass, the breeze, the ant crawling across her arm. Everything was her, and she was everything. Confused, Caro took her coffee cup to the dish bin. Adding to her confusion was her awareness that, as she and Trevor talked, attraction to him, not there when they'd first sat down, had begun to tug at her. He was so unusual, so open, so alive. Well, so she was attracted to him. So what? She'd been initially attracted to Julian, too, until she knew him better. Even Paul Becker had once looked appealing to her. She had bad taste in men. But she was hardly unique in that. Consider Molly. Caro had a job to do here at the compound, a job that affected not only her own future, but also Ellen, Kayla, and Angelica. That was going to stay Caro's focus. She went to join Barbara for more brain data analysis. The job was going well. The next day, everything fell apart.